I'm Dory Smith with a WHUS Public Affairs Department special, Rahul Mahajan reporting from Iraq, April 15, 2004. Rahul Mahajan visited the state of Connecticut recently for a forum at West Hartford Town Hall with former Chief UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter. The two made a profound case about the danger of mistakes being made by the Bush administration in Iraq, Afghanistan, and at home. The audio in this broadcast starts out a bit uneven. It is via satellite from Iraq. However, it does improve. Listeners online can go immediately to www.empirenotes.com to read Rahul Mahajan's current reports from Iraq. We're here with Rahul Mahajan. He's reporting from Baghdad. And Rahul, how was last night? Tell us the most recent news and fill us in about the killing of an Iranian official today.
Well, I don't think I can tell you about the killing of the Iranian official that was on the news report. I think it's very interesting to see that all of a sudden, when the United States has a problem, it has most of our southern, they turn to the axis of evil for help. And that the negotiations right now and just do involve the Iranians. As for us, we were very relieved to find some of our friends, British and American, who had gone back into Fallujah to try to brave U.S. sniper fire and rescue more wounded. And you should know, Dory, that the big untold story of Fallujah is that people get shot in the street, wounded. They lie there or they're dragged back into their homes and often can't make it to medical care at all because the ambulances can't get through to them because of the sniper fire. Anyway, these people had been into Fallujah. They were a day late returning, and we got very worried, and we just found out that they had been the guest of the Mujahideen for 24 hours.
Now, when you say guest, do you mean that they couldn't leave, or was there a question about that?
I mean, they were taken into custody by the Mujahideen, but I talked to one of them. She said they were treated extremely well, and once the Mujahideen were satisfied about their bona fides, they sent them on their way. So it turned out it was really not a problem, although it was a little frightening for them at the beginning.
Talk a little bit more about the fact that this story is not getting out of the snipers in Fallujah. We've also heard some reports from England, and these are published in the British press now, that there is just still an ongoing horrible level of violence in Fallujah where the U.S. military continues to attack Iraqis. What do you know about that, Rahul Mahajan?
Well, from what I'm told by the people who just returned, it's actually it's even hotter now in Fallujah than it was when we went earlier, and it's not just snipers now. They've resumed more regular bombardment as well. The story is slowly starting to percolate out. It's all one group of people, this British journalist Lee Gordon and a whole bunch of others of us who knew him. We went in together to Fallujah and in different ways and different avenues. We've been getting our reports out. We're the only group of non-Arabs who have been reporting on this, and of course it's very sad, but it is true that people are paying more attention to our reports than they are to the ones from Al Jazeera, which are actually, frankly, more comprehensive.
And we are given to understand that there's no way to get aid in or wounded out, and that the level of hospital care for Iraqis that are being shot or hurt by bombs is terrible. What do you know about that?
That's a situation that changes from day to day and from convoy to convoy. There is not a blanket ban. Some aid is getting in. Some people are getting out. They're very reluctant to allow what they call military-age Iraqi males either in or out. They are basically treating every military-age male as an enemy fighter. But some aid is getting in. I think the internal problems of communication within Fallujah are just as great, or perhaps even more important, than the fact that it's cordoned off from the rest. And also, the U.S. cordon is not complete because, frankly, as far as I know, to this day, they haven't been able to maintain a full cordon, and so there are back roads which are controlled by Mujahideen, and people can get through that way.
Now, Rahul Mahajan, as author of Full Spectrum Dominance, you are used to analyzing these kinds of situations. How do you analyze events in Iraq this April?
Well, let me go back to my trip in January. What I found out in my trip in January, which was quite an eye-opener to me, because I knew from the mainstream media news reporting on the occupation that things were very bad, but I had no idea quite how bad they were. I mean, the fact that actually, you know, life in Iraq now is worse for the average person than it was under Saddam and the sanctions, the twin brutalities, if you will, of Saddam and the sanctions. The fact that hospitals are worse off now, it was a shocker to me. And whenever I went around Baghdad, I mean, I'll tell you, Dory, literally over 90% of people would tell you, you know, things are worse now than they were before the war. So there was that incredible feeling of resentment against the occupation. There were constant stories about the brutality and what people always characterize as the cruelty of the American forces in particular, much more so than the British and other forces. And that resentment was there in the air, and yet there seemed very little resistance. The military resistance was small and isolated. What's changed is, with the events of late March and April, that feeling of resentment has now crystallized into open opposition. People are tired and not going to take it anymore, and many of them are going to join either the Sunni Mujahideen factions in Al-Anbar province where Fallujah is, or perhaps the Mokhtar al-Sadr's Navy Army, although there's a real question, an internal Shia division. But however that works out, you're going to see there's not going to be any dying down of open resistance now for the foreseeable future.
We were poised, waiting to see what the U.S. military was going to do in Najaf, but have heard little about the standoff there as U.S. forces have surrounded Najaf. Have you heard anything about that holy city and what is going on there?
Well, from whatever one can hear, and honestly, on a lot of this stuff, we depend on the same kind of reports you can access there. From whatever I have been able to gather, they are trying to work out some kind of deal whereby Mokhtar al-Sadr will not be immediately taken into custody, but may face trial in a future, quote, sovereign Iraq, whatever that means. The United States doesn't seem to be wanting to let any sovereignty happen, because the United States has realized that an assault on Najaf would simply make the country absolutely ungovernable. It's right on the verge of it right now. So I have a feeling of de-escalation, but anything could happen because most of the military commanders involved in this seem to be just, you know, phenomenally stupid. They have the idea that all they have to do is use enough force and they can prevail.
We had heard that the U.S. military commanders were constantly in touch through computers to these leaders in the field. Isn't it possible that they could be given orders to stand down? How does that apply to the U.S. military today, which has got to be suffering from massive frustration, exhaustion, and probably even PTSD?
How does what apply? Orders to stand down?
Well, do you think that the U.S.
I don't quite.
Do you think that the U.S. military commanders in the chief command centers are still able to run things through these technical computerized contact systems they have in Humvees, where they're actually supposedly in command from the top down to these field commanders?
Oh, I see. I understand. I think that the chain of command works more or less with one very glaring exception. Right down at the bottom level where you have the actual enlisted men directly facing the Iraqis, there is very little restraint on what they can do. I don't even know what the technical regulations are, but since they're never enforced, they're really meaningless. The ignorance, I mean, very few of them can speak even the words of Arabic. The real arrogant view that they have towards Iraqis. I mean, one British officer speaking, you know, I'm terrified by the attitude that the Americans treat the Iraqis as intermention. And that, of course, provokes all kinds of incidents and causes all kinds of violence. And I don't suppose that's part of the official military chain of command, but it doesn't really matter to me because they're creating the situations in which it's going to happen and they're doing nothing to stop it from happening.
Well, again, to go over events in Fallujah, we're hearing that there are still ongoing casualties, hundreds of people already dead, at least 700 that the U.S. military is admitting were killed, and many wounded. These are people that the U.S. military spokespersons continue to call insurgents. Describe who is actually getting hurt right now by our forces.
Well, one thing you have to understand is that at least in Al Anbar province, no women are fighting. Any woman who gets killed is a civilian without any question. And the American soldiers know this because when we passed back and forth, they didn't search the women. They didn't even search the American women and English women who were with us. So the reports I saw when the number was only 600, there were reports of 200 women, and that's very much consistent with what I saw. About close to half of the wounded I saw coming into the little clinic that I was at were women. I saw an 18-year-old girl who was almost certainly a terminal case. She was seizing and foaming at the mouth when she came in. She'd been shot through the head. I saw several children who were attacked. The people who are being killed and shot are just a cross section of the population of Fallujah. It seems to be nothing more than that. I mean, there's not even any. It doesn't even seem like there's a higher concentration of young men who are among the wounded.
And so, getting back to our discussion about command orders, the orders are to shoot to kill all Iraqis in Fallujah. I mean, I don't think we can quite grasp this here in America. How would you describe it? Put it into words for us, Rahul.
No, of course, those aren't the orders. I mean, if they wanted to simply kill everyone in Fallujah, there are easier ways to do it than sending in snipers. It's just that there's no regard for civilians who get killed. Now, they're shooting at ambulances deliberately. This has been documented by many of us. In fact, I have a picture of a sniped ambulance up on my website at empirenotes.org. And, of course, what they claim is that there are mujahideen who use the cover of ambulances, the mujahideen who drive ambulances and then fire at people. I don't believe that myself. I have seen no evidence of that. But, you know, who knows, maybe it's happened, or certainly they're claiming that, and that's the excuse for shooting at the ambulances. But basically they're just very, very trigger-happy, very, very jumpy and nervous, and have no strong orders to desist from doing things that are likely to cause civilian casualties. That's what it is. I don't think it's a deliberate attempt to kill everyone in Fallujah.
Describe for us who you mean by the mujahideen in Iraq at this point. Who are these people? What is their cause as they're expressing it? I know we're seeing some reports that they're using quite heavy rhetoric now about American forces. But who are they, Rahul?
Well, you know, mujahid just means holy warrior. And, you know, I mean, many of the people who are listening may have grown up with this song, Onward Christian Soldiers, you know, Onward Christian Soldiers marching off to war or something like that. Well, that it's just the equivalent here. It sounds horrible and foreign and nasty to a lot of Americans, but it's the same thing. There are people who fighting to defend what they feel is an attack on their faith, Islam, just like we've had Christian soldiers doing at so many points in the past. So they are very much, at least in some provinces, just of the people. I mean, in Fallujah, they're just a cross section of military age men. I mean, there's nothing really politically that distinguishes one a man who's working as a doctor and another who's working as a mujahideen. Right now, in fact, the doctors often depend on the mujahideen to bring the wounded into the clinics to treat them, and they deal with their neighbors. They've been part of the same community for a long time. In other areas, it's a little bit different. I mean, the the members of the Mehdi militia, for example, a lot of them come from the urban slums and are generally the poorer and disaffected. And a lot of them were small-time petty criminals under Saddam, like pickpockets and so on. And they simply have no prospects for employment. The stipend they get is for serving in the militia is for some of them enough of an inducement to stay. But there's also, of course, the fact that they're very, very militantly opposed to the occupation. So it's nothing special. It's not like the Mujahideen are, on the average, are not like the people in Al-Qaeda. They don't have, a lot of them don't have any particularly extremist form of fundamentalist religion. It's just that they're now fighting against the occupation because they see it as an assault on their way of life. I mean, I should add that some of the Mujahideen are extremists. It's just that's the same as true of the U.S. Army. Some of them are Christian fundamentalists, but on the whole, they're just normal Muslims who are fed up with the occupation.
Now, Rahul Mahajan, you have mentioned that Lee Gordon has been reporting about his experience, too, going into Fallujah. And there are reports now. There was a Page One story last week in the Sunday Telegraph where Lee Gordon described having gone into Fallujah with the Mujahideen. And in that, there is discussion, too, of what exactly U.S. military is using. And there are mentions of drones, U.S. military drones and helicopters overhead, shelling and bombing, and this would include houses in civilian areas. I call your attention to some of the dialogue at the 911 Commission hearings going on in Washington, where they're discussing the fact that they failed to use these drones to adequately target members of there is discussion of the use of these drones in the 911 Commission hearings as if somehow that technology,
for assassination.
Yes, and as if somehow that would have saved us from events on 911. Talk a little bit about all this militarization and description of what was once totally against international law and for reasons that wars were prevented by these laws.
Well, of course, it seems pretty clear to me that the Predator drones flying over Fallujah are simply doing reconnaissance, which is to say, of course, they're finding places that will then be bombed by other devices. I doubt they're being used to deliver missiles for the simple reason that they're very highly vulnerable targets, and they probably don't want to expose them to fire from the Mujahideen. So the attacks are being done with AC-130 helicopter gunships, with F-16s, with really fearsome killing instruments. There's no question about that. The whole talk about it's amazing to me that all the 911 Commission is focusing on the idea that somehow all this could have been solved if we had just gone to war with Afghanistan earlier, if we had pounded them harder, if we had done more international terrorism by making ourselves judge, jury, and executioner over people we didn't like with Hellfire missiles fired from Predators. It's just shocking, especially when it's so clear that a little bit more security vigilance might have protected us from 9/11, and it's also so clear in the aftermath of 9/11 that this militaristic path we've taken has dramatically increased the risks to all of us.
We're talking with Rahul Mahajan. He is the author of Full Spectrum Dominance. You can read his immediate reports from Iraq by going online to empirenotes.org. Tell us about your experience in being in this war zone and writing these immediate reports home. What is it all like? Tell us about what you're going through, Rahul.
Well, I should start by saying that there are no running internet cafes in Fallujah, and so the reports from there were not exactly instant. We had to wait to come back and file them. It's been an interesting experience. There's no doubt about it. This was my first time in a war zone, but it was so important. We all thought to make sure that we could corroborate if they turned out to be true, the reports in Al Jazeera and so on that were being so systematically ignored by the Western public and the Western media. I think that is changing slowly. I'm certainly getting responses from a lot of people who are saying, oh, that, you know, what you're saying is complete garbage, which it means at least that they are seeing those reports. So it's been a very valuable experience. The last few days has been very, we've all been sort of getting cabin fever because with the kidnappings, no one is sure about where we can go that really makes sense to go, even in the Baghdad area. And we've all been kind of lying low and wondering which direction the violence and the tension is going to go.
You write recently that people are being targeted, apparently intellectuals. Tell us more about that, about the targeting of people in specific.
Well, this has been happening ever since the so-called regime change. There's so many old scores to settle in Iraq. There's also, you know, anyone who just wants to maintain an independent voice and criticize things is and belongs to no particular faction. Well, then he has no one to protect him when any of the other factions want to commit violence. The universities are taken over by extremist organizations of one kind or another. Mokhtar al-Sadr's people, for example, certainly have a major presence in all the big Baghdad universities. These kinds of things are going on. There is simply no force that exists to deal with them. There's nothing like the police one can imagine, one knows of in the United States. There are some people technically called the Iraqi police, but nobody takes them seriously, and frankly, they're less well-armed than the average shopkeeper, and so they do nothing. There's no government office that keeps records of things. I mean, if you go and you steal somebody's car and you have the key, nobody's ever going to come and catch you because there's no record that the other person even owned the car. And this, of course, all these problems are writ large when it comes to murder or kidnapping. There is simply not even the slightest effort at an attempt to do any serious law enforcement in this society.
Now, the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan does have a representative in Iraq right now, Lakhdar Brahimi, who has been providing press conferences to the media, and he has said that violence must be controlled, elections must be held, but that the U.S. military use of force right now may actually be making things worse. To what extent have you become aware of any U.N. presence and relevance in what's going on in Iraq right now?
Well, there's no U.N. presence here. There's simply Lakhdar Brahimi, who was brought in to oversee negotiations. In fact, the minimal U.N. presence that was there earlier was really pulled out back in the fall. You know, there was an office of the U.N. development program and so on. But the U.N. is being brought in only to help the United States solve one particular problem, not to give it any kind of authority.
And we are then also dealing with leaders within the Islamic world, and a lot of imams have gone to Najaf. We haven't heard what exactly is going on as a consequence of that. But for listeners who don't understand, the situation in Najaf is that Muqtada al-Sadr is there, and so is the leading Ayatollah Sistani. A lot of people have been trying to work things out. The U.S. military stands poised outside of Najaf and could well do the same things there that have been going on in Fallujah. That's what everyone fears. In the meantime, some of the neoconservatives, according to Jim Loeb, he's the Washington bureau chief of Interpress News and writing on foreign policy in Focus, that he's an expert on these neoconservatives in power in Washington today, and is writing that there seems to be some effort on their part to characterize all of the imams in their situation in Najaf right now this way, that they have been led by Tehran. First comment on that amazing assertion that is being fed upstream in the American media. And then also, Rahul Mahajan, characterize what you have posted on your website about the mosques in Iraq in general, in particular in Baghdad, that you reported on.
Okay, and with that, I'm going to have to wrap it up, Dory, because it's getting dark over here, and I need to get a move on. Well, to start with about Iran, Muqtada al-Sadr, his father was a grand ayatollah, someone very important in the Shiite religious hierarchy, and he's also a martyr killed by Saddam Hussein. But al-Sadr is a very young man. In fact, almost every Iraqi will tell you he's 25 or under. He's had no time or chance to rise in the religious hierarchy, and so he's needed to have many different ways of trying to bolster his legitimacy. One is, of course, as the son of his father, but another has been by connection with an Iranian grand ayatollah, Kazim al-Hayri, I believe is his name. And there is that connection. There's no doubt about that. And al-Sadr does have similar beliefs to some of the Iranian ayatollahs about, for example, the rule of a theocracy of the Islam. The rule of what Khomeini calls Vilayat al-Faqih, the rule of the just Islamic jurisprudence. So there are some similarities and some connections. He's not acting as an agent of Iran. In fact, he has an Iraq for Iraqi Senate. His father was the only Iraqi Grand Ayatollah, really, who's Iraqi of the main ones. Sistani is originally Iranian. And so, yes, they are bringing in some Iranian clerics to help them deal with the standoff situation. But Najaf is one of the primary sites for Shiite theology in the whole world. The other one of the same caliber is Qom in Iran. And, you know, people like Sistani, he's been based in Najaf for decades now, and there's a whole huge number of clerics around him. Most of the people involved in these negotiations undoubtedly are Iraqi clerics. The Iranian ones are just there because of that connection I've said that Muqtada al-Sadr has with them. And can you tell me the other question again?
Yes. You have reported on the mosque in Iraq, and you were reporting specifically on Abu Hanifa.
Yes. Abu Hanifa is the primary Sunni mosque in all of Iraq. It's built around the tomb of Abu Hanifa, who founded the Hanafi school of Islamist jurisprudence, has existed for over 1,250 years. It has been the subject of three raids by the Americans. The third raid came just a few days ago, early morning Sunday. American troops claiming they're looking for mujahideen and or for weapons. It was a major source for coordination of relief efforts for Fallujah, and so there were tons and tons of materials to be taken to Fallujah, and the U.S. military has had suspicions that some of these relief materials actually contain guns or RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, things like that. So they came to search, but they didn't say, you know, contact the imam, say, we need to be assured that this is just humanitarian, please let us in, nothing like that. They did the raids the way they always do. At 3:30 in the morning, a tank dashes in each of the gates, and then they drive their Hummers in. They destroy a lot of the relief supplies, not the majority, but a significant amount. They smashed windows and doors. We went throughout the Imam Adam Islamic College Seminary, which is a school associated with the mosque, and we saw just about every door had been smashed in, numerous windows destroyed. They rifled through students' papers. There were also about 100 people in the mosque, and they were taken and, in a typical way, very typical of the way the U.S. soldiers do it, slammed down on the ground, had a gun put to the back of their heads. One of them, in fact, we interviewed, who speaks very good English, he said he kept on shouting in English, you know, we can help you, we can unlock the doors for you. In fact, some of the doors were even unlocked, some of the ones that they bashed in. Just please tell us what you want, we'll help you find it. But they paid him absolutely no attention. There were also, in addition, numerous bullet holes. They had, in many places, when they wanted to search the ceilings for weapons and for concealed fighters, they would fire a bunch of shots at the ceiling first and then have someone go and climb up and search them. It was really quite an atrocious thing. They didn't find any weapons.
Rahul Mahajan, we hope you go and do what you have to do now as it's getting dark in Iraq. Thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to talking with you again and to all of your writing on empirenotes.org.
Great. Thanks a lot, Dory.
Take care. Rahul Mahajan is author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, Seven Stories Press is the publisher. You can find the book online at www.sevenstories.com. Thank you for listening. I'm Dori Smith. For further information about this broadcast, write to me at rcrradio@aol.com. This program was produced by the Public Affairs Department at WHUS Stores. You can log on to listen at www.whus.org. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or the University of Connecticut.